Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, you want to write the great American novel or read the greats again with a more knowing eye? Francine Prose is your guru and guide. A dozen novels into her own enviable career, she says the secret to great writing is great reading and its inspirations. Homer for plot, Samuel Johnson for the lucid sentence, Flannery O'Connor for the word that makes all the difference, Virginia Woolf and Hemingway and Tim O'Brien for virtuosity, Chekhov for unworldly knowing. For the aspiring writer or the reader who wants it all, here's the roadmap to riches. Up next on Point, pull out your earbuds and kill the video. We're cracking the great books to read like a writer. Joining me from New York is Francine Prose. She teaches writing at Bard College and the New School and is the widely admired author of a dozen books, fiction and nonfiction, including A Changed Man and Blue Angel, for which was a finalist for the National Book Award. She writes book reviews, essays, and cultural criticism for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Harper's Magazine. Her new book is called Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Francine Prose, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst and no mean reader, Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ms. Prose.
It's great to have you both. Francine Prose, what's your project here? There's some great reading in here. We look forward to diving into it. But give us the frame. What are you up to?
Well, I want to start people reading in a different way, for one thing. I mean, that is, reading closely, word by word, line by line, seeing what's on the page, and thinking about all the decisions that a writer had to make in the first place to put those words on the page. And also, for people who want to be writers, it seems to me, as you mentioned, that the real way to learn is by looking at how great geniuses have done a certain thing. I mean, I think often in creative writing classrooms, the way that writing is taught is to look at something that's been done wrong and to try and figure out how to fix it, whereas why not look at something that's done brilliantly and try and figure out how that's been done?
So you want us to get in and not just float through the reading, but really pay attention down at the paragraph, sentence, word level. You know, I saw in the Washington Post, Maureen Corrigan, who NPR listeners will know for her book reviews, reviewed yours, and she asked the question, do you really want to read like a writer? She's asking the readers, think carefully about that question, because you may come to rue the powers you desire. That is, breaking everything down, like taking apart the automobile engine, or do you just want to drive the car? I mean, does everybody want to read like a writer? How do writers read?
Well, you know, always after you've written the book, then you realize the thing that you should have said in the book. So what I wished I had said was, the first time you read something, go ahead and read it just for pleasure. I mean, just see what's there and read it for the plot and for the enjoyment and for just the pure joy. And then go back and look at those word choices and those sentence structures and so forth. And you know, the fact that you want to go back and look at a certain piece of literature that closely is a key that piece of writing has something to say to you.
So, and you also inform us right at the get-go of the book, here you've been teaching writing for 20 years, and yet people always ask you, can writing be taught? And you say, come on, what do you think I've been doing for all these years? But in some sense, you seem to be turning back and say, at some level saying, just go read.
Yeah, well, I'm still not sure that writing can be taught, but certainly writing has to be learned. You have to learn it from somewhere. And what I'm saying is that I and most of the writers I know really, when it came down to it, learned by reading great writers and as I say, seeing or trying to see how they did something.
Jack Beattie, I know certainly my own apprehension of the world, comprehension, rides on an ocean of books and hours and months and years of joyful reading from a very early age. I can't imagine life without it. And yet Francine Prose is saying, well, let's go back in there and pick up the jewels and see what we can learn about writing from them. Do you want to dissect and bisect your books, Jack?
Yes, and let me give you some jewels. Francine will have many more. But I have a category in my mental file of writing called the lapidary formulation, the thing that was oft-thought but ne'er so well expressed. And here, for example, is Thomas Hobbes on sexual intercourse. The pleasure is brief, the expense ridiculous, the posture ridiculous. The pleasure is brief, the expense exorbitant, the posture ridiculous. hard to beat that. You
perfectly
know?
Economical on one of the greatest subjects of all time.
And yet, you know, that will to say a thing as if written in stone lives. Here's Shirley Hazard, the very last sentence of her wonderful novel, The Great Fire, about World War II. Many had died, but not she, not he, not yet.
Ah, wow. Francine Prose, you say that great writers put each word on trial for its life as they dive in here. You go sort of category by category, looking at examples, word, sentence, paragraph, dialogue, and right on down. I wish you'd begin to take us in there. There's a bit from Flannery O'Connor that will help us think about word choice. I wish you'd describe what she's on about here. This is from A Good Man Is Hard to Find, and then take us in if you'd be good enough.
Sure. It's the opening paragraph from A Good Man Is Hard to Find. The grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. She wanted to visit some of her connections in East Tennessee, and she was seizing at every chance to change Bailey's mind. Bailey was the son she lived with, her only boy. He was sitting on the edge of his chair at the table, bent over the orange sports section of the journal. "Now look here, Bailey," she said. "See here, read this." And she stood with one hand on her thin hip and the other rattling the newspaper at his bald head. "Here this fellow that calls himself the Misfit is a loose from the federal pen and headed toward Florida, and you read here what it says he did to these people. Just you read it. I wouldn't take my children in any direction with a criminal like that a loose in it. I couldn't answer to my conscience if I did."
Okay, Francine Prose, reading from Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man Is Hard to Find. You say one way to compel yourself to get it is to slow down and stop at every word to ask what sort of information each word choice is conveying. What's Flannery O'Connor, the great one, doing with us here?
Well, for starters, the fact that she's chosen to call her character the grandmother as opposed to Mrs. Smith or Ethel Smith or Ethel, I mean, it gives her a kind of mythic role, the grandmother, and also it sort of reduces her and at the same time elevates her to her role in the family. And then, you know, the grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. The first sentence is a kind of refusal, this kind of negative statement. I mean, the grandmother's really digging in her heels. She didn't want to go to Florida.
So a concentrated act of negative will in that short, brief sentence.
Right. She is not doing it. So again, you know, here we have just a few words, one sentence, and we have a lot of information about this character, what she's doing, what she doesn't want. You know, then you go on. She wanted to visit some of her connections in East Tennessee. I mean, connections right away, you know, without it gives you a kind of sense of where you are. I mean, it's the South, mm-hmm. connections, you know, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, often when people try and convey what region, they do it by like dropping the G's on partisan, mm-hmm. you know, but just that word connections, it gets you right there.
And quickly, though, of course, in this story, we see, as you remind us, the foolishness of attempting to exert one's will when fate or destiny are on the way. But she gets us started with those few words and what you describe as the no-nonsense austerity of that construction. You compare it in a funny way to Moby Dick's first sentence, "Call me Ishmael," just the authority of the author in control. The grandmother didn't want to go to Florida.
Well, you read a sentence like that, or you read a sentence like "Call Me Ishmael," and you know right away that the writer knows what she or he is doing. And it is a kind of authority, kind of narrative control. And you think, okay, let's read further and see what's going to happen next.
Let's take another. F. Scott Fitzgerald, still in the word category, learning from the writers. And you say, you know, he could be lazy, he could use cliches, but when he got focused, for example, in the description of the rose-colored grand hotel that opens tender as the night, his use of the word deferential, palms, cool, its flushed facade, and before it stretches a short, dazzling beach. But then you take us to The Great Gatsby, the moment when Nick Carraway sees Daisy and her friend Jordan for the first time. Here's word choice in a great scene. Could you read some of that for us?
Sure. The windows were ajar and gleaming white against the fresh grass outside that seemed to grow a little way into the house. A breeze blew through the room, blue curtains in at one end and out the other like pale flags, twisting them up toward the frosted wedding cake of the ceiling, and then rippled over the wine-colored rug, making a shadow on it as wind does on the sea.
Wow, terrific.
And I mean, right there, you know, it's not, the wind doesn't actually make a shadow on the rug, and it doesn't, the grass isn't growing into the room, but you know exactly what's happening here. I mean, it's such a perfect way of putting it.
Or even, I mean, does the wind make a shadow on the sea? I tried to think to myself, now wait a minute, I thought those were clouds making shadows on the sea.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's completely wrong, but you know exactly what he's talking about.
Word by word. Gorgeousness here. Is this the path that you put your writing students on? Is this the way?
Well, yeah. I mean, that is, you know, well, again, what I should say is what I tell my students is write a first draft however you can. Just get it down on the page. Don't worry about any of this, because if you did, you would never write a second sentence if you've been working on the first over and over and over, or you'd never write a second chapter. But then after you have something done, I mean, there is that quality that that activity that a friend calls putting every word on trial for its life. And you say, is this the right word? Can I find a better word? Can I cut this word? Can I cut this whole sentence? Do I really need this scene? And that's really how writing, I think, gets done, in that process of revision, of making sure that every sentence is as good and as rhythmic and concise and elegant and practical and useful as it can be.
And if you're writing, it's a toolkit. And if you're just reading, it's joy, as with F. Scott Fitzgerald there. Francine Prose, you've got so many in here. I mean, Chekhov as your kind of god of gods, but Joyce and Austin and Tolstoy and Nabokov and Raymond Carver and James Baldwin, Alice Munro, on and on. It has put my mind back. I mean, I suppose half the liberal arts majors in the country years ago took a creative writing course. The teacher was Gordon Lish. He was fiction editor at the Esquire magazine in those days, big champion of Raymond Carver. Who you cite here. But his number one directive was less about reading and about technique, though that was there, but it was tell the truth. Tell the truth no matter how particular or peculiar, and it will be universal. It will touch all. What about that as a directive beyond reading?
Well, I suppose it's a good suggestion. Although, you know, I mean, there's so many versions of the truth, it's hard to know exactly. You know, I do quote, there's that marvelous passage from Hemingway in A Movable Feast in which he talks about writing the one true sentence. But what I say is that I never had any idea what he meant. So maybe he meant the one beautiful sentence, and it's sort of easier to talk about what a beautiful sentence is than a true sentence.
That sounds more like beauty. So many maxims, so many directions. Jack, what are you reading lately? What are you digging into?
Well, I've been reading on and off for the last couple of years The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. For the analogies. And what I have discovered with Gibbon is simplicity. You know, I think when young writers, we all like to use the gorgeous modifier. But here's what Gibbon does with the very simple word. The revolution of Arabia had not changed the character of the Arabs. The death of Mahomet was the signal of independence, and the hasty structure of his power and religion tottered to its foundation.
Wow.
The hasty structure. And here he is at the fall of Constantinople. The Greeks have a legend that an angel will descend and defend them at the last. The Turks are crashing at the doors of St. Sophia. The Greeks are praying. And here's Gibbon. While they expected the descent of the tardy angels, the doors were broken with axes. The tardy angels.
Hasty structure, tardy angels. Wow. Wow, that's terrific stuff. Jack, you're reading there for Resonance right now. And I see, Francine Prose, it's one of the books. You've got a list at the back, books to be read immediately. And there are, I don't know, more than 100 here, Gibbon among them.
Yeah, God, everything that Jack has read so far has made me wish I'd put it in the book.
Well, you said this whole project was a little bit like Tom Sawyer's project. You'd ask your friends, and they'd all paint a little bit of the fence for you. How did you choose who, what was in and what was not? And speak to something you write about early in the book, how you kind of got tired of old authors being trashed and said, no, let's look here for models.
Well, I did write it like Tom Sawyer painting the fence, because I was constantly calling my friends, other writers, and emailing them. And for example, when I was writing the chapter on paragraphs, I was, and for one thing, I mean, it was sort of shocking to me that no one had written about paragraphs very much. I mean, it's such a basic unit of everything we write, but I felt I was kind of striking out weirdly into new territory. So I emailed David Gates, the novelist, and I said, well, who's a great paragraph writer, or, you know, what's a great source to go to? And he said that in a there's a Rex Stout mystery in which Nero Wolfe solves a case, a plagiarism case, by pointing out that no two writers paragraph the same way, and that it's a more telling sign of who's written something than word choice and so forth. And so I found this marvelous paragraph from Rick Stout about paragraphing, and I never would have thought to look there. I mean, and it was absolutely the perfect choice that I needed.
We can dive in almost anywhere here, but let's look at paragraphs for a second. One of the paragraph models you cite is Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections. Now, I have to say, it's not my personal favorite, but I see why you've got this paragraph here. It's a fascinating sort of journey within one graph, as journalists would say. Set it up for us and give us a read, if you would, Francine Prost.
Okay, it's from the early chapter, and one of the characters, Chip, is watching his parents arrive at the airport.
And you might as well tell us the dynamics that you find so interesting before you read it so that we can follow along and hear them with you.
Right. Well, at the beginning, you think you're getting a kind of neutral third-person description of these two elderly people showing up at the airport at the gate. And when you get to the end, the very last sentence in the end, you go, oops, this is not neutral at all. You're really watching this from Chip's point of view, and what you might have thought is very different from what he's seeing.
Let's hear it from The Corrections, okay. Jonathan Franzen.
Down the long concourse they came unsteadily, Enid favoring her damaged hip, Alfred paddling at the air with loose, hinged hands and slapping the airport carpeting with poorly controlled feet, both of them carrying Nordic Pleasure Line shoulder bags and concentrating on the floor in front of them, measuring out the hazardous distance three paces at a time. To anyone who saw them averting their eyes from the dark-haired New Yorkers careering past them, to anyone who caught a glimpse of Alfred's straw fedora looming at the height of Iowa corn on Labor Day, or the yellow wool of the slack stretching over Enid's outslung hip, it was obvious that they were Midwestern and intimidated. But to Chip Lambert, who was waiting for them just beyond the security checkpoint, they were killers.
They were killers, and this is not a neutral observer. The view alters and complicates what we've been seeing. Francine Prose reading from Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections on A Paragraph to Read and Delight In. Carrie's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I desperately needed to hear what you guys are talking about this morning.
Great. Why?
Oh, I'm an only child, was raised by military parents, traveled around the country from east to coast to west coast, north, south. So I was always the new kid, didn't fit in, and books were my companions and my family. And I read omnivorously, continuously, actually without any selection or thought. I managed to read Moby Dick and a bunch of the huge books in high school.
So it saved your youth. Did it turn you into a celebrating reader or also a writer, Carrie?
It turned me into somebody that uses four-bit words, as my dad says, and causes me problems with communication with my fellows. But what it has done is inspire me to write my novel, which lies on a shelf gathering dust, about my summer vacation at 40, taking a trip to Europe by myself and all the wonderful adventures I had. I shared my trip with friends, and they said, oh, you must write it. So there it lies, and I'm looking for inspiration to resurrect it and share it with people.
And maybe you've got it today, but let me ask you this. When you have the novel out and you're working on it, can you feel that ocean of reading from your youth still flowing through your fingers as you write?
I don't know that it's conscious, but the words are always ready for me. I have a vocabulary that's really quite extensive, even on my graduate requirements exam for master's program.
Yep.
I was right up there in the 90 percentile, and it kind of makes me feel sad for all those college people, and I got it from reading. It certainly wasn't from reading the dictionary.
Hey, don't feel sad. Feel glad for what you've got there, and we're glad for that call. Let me get one more. Sam from Wallingford, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about how, in my experience, when I was about 15, someone had suggested to me Jack Kerouac, and he's a lot different than a lot of the writers you guys were talking about.
Yes.
Because he was kind of anti- rewriting and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was his kind of long, almost cerebral descriptions of things that really got me into writing. And made me even appreciate more the, you know, Hemingways and all of that, that really looked into how much greater it can be.
We hear it. Kerouac got you on the road. Sam, thanks very much for that. Francine, there's a couple of views from big readers. What about Kerouac and his more freestyle? Do you cite it? Does it make your great writing template?
Well, I read it when I was, you know, maybe, well, I guess the same age as The Caller. And I loved it. I loved it when I read it. I mean, to tell the truth, I haven't gone back to it since then, so I have no idea. But you know, in general, I think anything that makes someone a reader, anything that turns someone on to books is really great. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't know the difference between a so-called good book and a so-called bad book. So, you know, I was reading anything that came into my hands. I mean, you know, big, fat James Michener novels. I didn't know that those were in quote-unquote literature. I just thought they were great. So, you know, just my advice is if a kid wants to read or a high schooler wants to read, anything they're reading is fine.
Jack, what about that kind of ocean of reading of origin that each of us has? I mean, do you feel it in your, you know, when you put pen to paper or hit the keyboard? I know sometimes myself, I can feel trapped in the King James Bible, as if it doesn't have that cadence, which, you know, was there every Sunday, then it's not worthy.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. John Keats said that writers are always looking over their shoulder to Shakespeare. You know, you say, my gosh, how did he do it? I can't do it that well. And these things creep in. And, you know, it's strange when you notice how much it creeps in with other writers. You begin to notice that, my gosh, this is Scott Fitzgerald I'm reading, only that's not the name of the author. There's a lot of unintentional. Yeah, there's a lot of unintentional, it seems, plagiarism out there, precisely because the writers that stick get repeated, and not just their words, but even their forms, even their stylistic tricks. And I find myself constantly lapsing into Samuel Johnson at all the wrong moments.
And how many Hemingway captives we have had this world. Francine Prose, how about it? If you had to choose between, let's say, Carrie or just someone who read voluminously, you know, from the time they were, I don't know, 5 until they were 25 and set out to write, or someone who you took by the hand and led into these close readings, which is the more effective path to great writing?
Oh, I think both at once. I think both together or sequentially or you know, I mean, I think, you know, why would you want to write unless you had become involved and experienced the pleasure of reading, however you read or whatever you read? I mean, that just that sense of, you know, it's just that ocean of words sweeping over you. I mean, I think that's the greatest impulse to actually want to write. But then when you're actually revising something and trying to figure out how it might work or how it might work better, then by all means, slow down and see how some great master did it.
Let's hear another example. We go to the sentence here, and you've got a few examples that you hold up. One really remarkable sentence from Virginia Woolf from her essay on being ill. It's 181 words long, a single sentence, but it's not the gigantism, you say, but it's lucidity. Could you read that for us? It's a single sentence from Virginia Woolf.
Yeah. That's the first sentence of her great essay on being ill, and it is 181 words long, and it's so clear. Here it goes. Considering how common illness is, how tremendous the spiritual change that it brings, how astonishing when the lights of health go down, the undiscovered countries that are then disclosed, what wastes and deserts of the soul a slight attack of influenza brings to view, what precipices and lawns sprinkled with bright flowers a little rise of temperature reveals, what ancient and obdurate oaks are uprooted in us by the act of sickness, how we go down into the pit of death and feel the waters of annihilation close above our heads and wake thinking to find ourselves in the presence of the angels and the harpers when we have a tooth out and come to the surface in the dentist's armchair and confuse his rinse the mouth with the greeting of the deity stooping from the floor of heaven to welcome us. When we think of this, as we are so frequently forced to think of it, it becomes strange indeed that illness has not taken its place with love and battle and jealousy among the prime themes of literature.
Francine Prose reading from the first line of Virginia Woolf's On Being Ill. Jack Beatty, my gosh, I'm a whole universe and a remarkable one that you know, we seldom thought about in that wonderment in one sentence.
Yeah, and here's the opposite of that. Here's our friend Gibbon again. This is simplicity, but it gets a similar effect. This is an attack on Constantinople. Their first fury was spent in the discharge of darts, stones, and fire from the engines. But the water was deep. The French were bold. The Venetians were skillful.
The discharge of darts and the deserts of the soul, a slight attack of influenza brings to view. It's great stuff. Ken is calling from Fort Erie in Ontario, Canada. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. It's great to be on your wonderful show. I'm almost speechless after hearing the Virginia Woolf sentence. I went blind at the age of 24 and always had been a great reader, but I dove more deeply into Shakespeare, and I think he even goes into the minute syllables, the last syllable of recorded time. Every syllable in Shakespeare is so well crafted that it's, I hope it's not too daunting to express that to writers to be that crafty, but...
It's pretty daunting. Shakespeare by Braille, Ken, is that where you...
No, on tape and records and so forth. I never quite got to be that adept at Braille, but I was thinking of some lines from Fitzgerald and O'Neill that sum up... some of the Irish lyric idea, and it's the wonderful last, the ending of Gatsby, so poetic and so gorgeous. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. And when you take that apart and you see how it seems like there's 2 feet, then 3 feet, then 4 feet, and the boats and the T's and the B's and all that. It's just so well crafted, but it's also so profound, and it reminds me of the last lines of the O'Neill Long Day's Journey Into Night, where Mary says, and then I married James Tyrone and was so happy for a while.
Ken, you are so welcome, and I hope you'll come again. It's good to feel you. Reading there in Ontario, thanks so much for that. Francine...
Oh, that was marvelous.
The shivers are right there. What about the great Shakespeare, or for that matter, King James and his Bible standing over all this? I mean, are we all... Do they define a universe? Are we all within their realm when we write in English, or is freedom possible?
Well, sure. I mean, there's so much to learn from, it sounds so obvious, from Shakespeare and the King James Bible. I mean, rhythm, for one thing. You know, when you think of the rhythm of Shakespeare or the cadences, or you think of the rhythm of the Bible, I mean, if you think of, just the book of Ecclesiastes, to take one example, or the Sermon on the Mount.
Otmar's calling from Pocatello, Idaho. Hi, Otmar. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure. I'd like to share this book with you. It's called West with the Night by Beryl Markham.
Okay.
It's a book that has left me and continuously leaves me deeply emotional. And the reason that it does is that she's almost like an impressionist painter. But I have to fill in. It's a simple sentence. It's very simple from story to story, but I have to fill in details. And it's in filling in those details that the power comes.
West with the Night, the impressionistic imprint there for you, and you filling in the details. Otmar, we love that view of how it works. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Cedar Falls, Iowa. Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there.
What do you know?
I love that Shakespeare has come into the conversation when we're talking about sentences, because my favorite sentence of all time is "blow winds and crack your cheeks."
Yes, but, we'll take it.
The recent preponderance of opportunities to publish has really, I think, watered down a lot of writing. We have a lot of writers who are drawing the lines but not coloring them in, and the most color seems to me to be coming from those who have turned to personal essay, like David Sedaris. Augustine Burroughs is one of my favorites currently, and he has a new book coming out called Possible Side Effects that I found this sentence in, and it just made me think, wow.
Let's hear it.
he's speaking of his grandmother, and he says, "Sometimes when she kissed me on the forehead at night, I flinched, worried a piece of her might chip off and stick to me."
Oh, gosh.
Now, what better way to personify a fear of not just the obvious, the literal, but also the inheritance that we get from our families. It just really touched me.
We're getting such great readers and such great passages. Stephanie, thank you very much for sharing that. Francine Prose, what about the question Stephanie raises on publishers and the care lavished or not lavished these days on books? Are we getting the same lapidary care that brings excellence to the prose?
Well, you know, we keep hearing how the novel is dead and the book is dying and so forth. But I keep, you know, books for whatever reason come into my house. I mean, maybe four or five books just show up at my door every week. And I read them and there's always something good. I mean, a friend of mine says the novel will be around at our funeral. And I think that that's true, that there's still actually wonderful writing being done. I mean, they're great memoirs, they're great novels being written. And in fact, it gives me a lot of hope because the written word is not on its way out, even though we keep hearing that readership is declining and so forth.
Jack Beatty, you're a great reader. Do you agree? The written word, is it hanging tough in the earbud era?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I think this is an age not only of visuals but of talk. We're surrounded by it, and talk isn't writing.
We're guilty of it right
here.
Yeah,
we're guilty of it. You know, we don't have time to put words on trial for their lives here. We just have to spill them out as they come. And I think that that's fine. But I sometimes am reading younger writers, what I'm struck with is, well, they're spontaneous enough. But that's not enough.
So that talk becomes text, and then there's a different standard.
Go. Yeah. I don't know what you think of that.
Francine?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's also true that books come in my house, and I think, gee, if this book had been put through the word processor like 15 more times, it would have been really great.
And yet, you know, even in that talk, Jack, Francine, I'm glad for the reading that the talker has done however many years ago. Hemingway keeps coming up. We can't avoid the guy. You've got a passage in here in your sentence chapter, Francine Prose, you know, vaguely lugubrious out on the in the bullfighting arena. And I've got a quibble with your interpretation, but I wish you'd read it for us first and tell us why you've included it here.
All right. Let me just...
The Sun Also Rises.
It's from The Sun Also Rises. And it's a kind of, a bu- well, it's a description of a bullfighter whose career is on its way down. Mm. Sometimes he turned to smile that toothed, long-jawed, lipless smile when he was called something particularly insulting. And always the pain that any movement produced grew stronger and stronger until finally his yellow face was parchment color. And after his second bull was dead and the throwing of bread and cushions was over, after he had saluted the president with the same wolf-jawed smile and contemptuous eyes and handed his sword over the Barrera to be wiped and put back in its case, he passed through into the Callejon and leaned on the Barrera below us, his head on his arms, not seeing, not hearing anything, only going through his pain.
Mm. Ernest Hemingway from The Sun Also Rises. You go on in the way of a writing, X-ray artist here to say it might have been no less rhythmic and a little more transparent if it had been turned around. And instead of the turning to smile first, that long-jawed, lipless smile, instead of if we were informed it was sometimes when he was called something particularly insulting, he turned to smile, that tooth, long-jawed, lipless smile. You said you might put the insult first, and I found myself thinking, I mean, you're interpreting so deeply here, but that in a way Hemingway's choice sort of mimics the sequence of machismo, which is that you smile before you let them glimpse the anger, and then the anger's more terrifying when it comes. Let's take a call. Scott's calling from Boston. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. I have to redo a passage from Michael Cunningham from
please.
The Hours.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
This plays off the quote you just had from Vineyard and Woolf. I've got this framed next to my desk.
Oh, great.
It's time for the day to be over. We throw our parties. We abandon our families to live alone in Canada. We struggle to write books that do not change the world, despite our gifts and our unstinting efforts, our most extravagant hopes. We live our lives, do whatever we do, and then we sleep. It's as simple and ordinary as that. A few jump out of windows or drown themselves or take pills. More die by accident. And most of us, the vast majority, are slowly devoured by some disease, or if we're very fortunate, by time itself. There's just this for consolation. An hour here or there when our lives seem against all odds and expectations to burst open and give us everything we've ever imagined. Though everyone but children, and perhaps even they, knows these hours will inevitably be followed by others far darker and more difficult. Still, we cherish the city, the morning. Mm. We hope more than anything for more. Mm.
Scott, I thought people hang in there, baby, by their desk. That's a different level. And do we not hear that Michael Cunningham has certainly read Virginia Woolf in that, Scott?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, the whole book is a play on Virginia Woolf, yeah.
Right. It's reading, and there it comes, kind of a whole vision of approaching life. Scott, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Francine, what about the payoff or the peril of reading a writer so closely that we become apes or ape?
Well, as I say in the book, you know, every so often I hear writers say, oh, I couldn't possibly read Chekhov or Tolstoy when I'm writing for fear that they might influence my work. And I always think, you wish. If in your dreams Chekhov or Tolstoy would have, you know, that's the best case scenario. So, I mean, I think it's true, especially when writers are starting out, that they're heavily influenced and they find themselves writing versions of another writer. But that's probably not so bad. I mean, eventually you grow out of it. I mean, what I keep saying, you know, is, you know, if 10 years later you're still writing imitation Hemingway or imitation Jack Kerouac or imitation Philip Roth, you've got a problem. But if it's your first few stories and that's what you're doing, you'll grow out of it.
Our time with you is short, and we want to look at some more of these jewels. You've got a passage. We've got soldiers in the field for good or ill right now, better or worse for them. You've got Tim O'Brien in here from the Vietnam era, The Things They Carried. And I wanted you to read, this is, again, is in your sentence category. I had writers who, as a young man, were turning my head. I mean, Tim O'Brien, among them, Michael Hare, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, all getting my attention. But there's a passage here where he gets very particular with soldiers in the field, in this case, in Vietnam. Why did you choose it? What should we listen for as you read it?
Well, it's got a marvelous rhythm, and the way in which the details give you the character of the men, and actually, you know, the large cast of characters that's introduced in this relatively brief passage just by telling you what they've got in their backpacks, it's all kind of extraordinary. The things they carried were largely determined by necessity. Among the necessities, or near necessities, were P-38 can openers, pocket knives, heat tabs, wristwatches, dog tags, mosquito repellent, chewing gum, candy, cigarettes, salt tabs. Henry Dobbins, who was a big man, carried extra rations. He was especially fond of canned peaches and heavy syrup over pound cake. Dave Jensen, who practiced field hygiene, carried a toothbrush, dental floss, and several hotel-sized bars of soap he'd stolen on R&R in Sydney, Australia. Ted Lavender, who was scared, carried tranquilizers until he was shot in the head outside the village of Tonkay in mid-April. By necessity, and because it was SOP, they all carried steel helmets that weighed 5 pounds, including the lining and camouflage cover. Necessity dictated. Because the land was mined and booby-trapped, it was SOP for each man to carry a steel-centered nylon-covered flak jacket which weighed 6.7 pounds, but which on hot days seemed much heavier. Because you could die so quickly, each man carried at least one large compress bandage, usually in the helmet for easy access. Because the nights were cold and because the monsoons were wet, each carried a green plastic poncho that could be used as a raincoat or ground sheet or makeshift tent. With its quilted liner, the poncho weighed almost 2 pounds, but it was worth every ounce. In April, for instance, when Ted Lavender was shot, they used his poncho to wrap him up, then to carry him across the paddy, then to lift him into the chopper that took him away.
Francine Prose reading from Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. Jack Beatty, there are almost a whole war in that short passage.
Yes, and it illustrates her point. She writes, "Rhythm gives power. Rhythm gives words a power that cannot be reduced to, or described by mere words." that the rhythm somehow conveys something that over and above and more than what the words do. And I think the next passage you use also has that, talks about the last lines of Joyce's The Dead, talking about the snow falling all over Ireland. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Furey lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead.
Terrific. They're also from James Joyce, and I read that as well, Jack, and you want to read it out loud. And I heard in that melody the sort of line of descent from Joyce to Dylan Thomas and Under Milk Wood. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't, the fingerprints are all over it. Is it a fair line of legacy there, Francine Prose? Have I got that right?
Sure, and probably it goes back to Homer if I could read Greek. I mean, you know, it's poetry. I mean, all the devices of poetry, rhythm, alliteration, cadence, it's all there. I mean, I often say that I teach that story of the dead partly just for an excuse to read that last paragraph aloud to my students.
It's a great paragraph. Chekhov, huge in your universe of inspirations, and so knowing. Can knowingness be studied, be learned from?
I don't know. I'm tempted to say it is kind of a spiritual quality that some people have, and Chekhov certainly had it. But he does, reading Chekhov does make you extraordinarily, if only for a moment, more compassionate, more sympathetic. I mean, I feel that every time I read a Chekhov story, I go out in the world and I think, oh, look at these people. They have their hopes and their fears and their pains. And, I wish it lasted longer, but it certainly works for a little while.
Mm. Give us one final piece of radio theater, if you would, on dialogue, if we've got time for it, from David Gates' story, The Wonders of the Invisible World. Not much set up because our time is short. If you just dive right in, let us hear this dialogue.
So, I said. So, she said. She took a deep breath and let it out. So, yours truly thinks she's pregnant. You're shitting me, I said. What do you mean you think? Well, for one thing, I'm like 3 weeks late, and I'm never late. Plus, I've been sick to my stomach the last 2 mornings. I went out this afternoon, I bought one of those pregnancy things, you know, at the drugstore. Except, I'm too scared to use it. Unbelievable, I said. Really, she said. How could it have happened, though? If I knew that, she said, it wouldn't have happened. Obviously, I don't know. Some stupid thing, I'm sure.
Billie Holiday was singing Baby Get Lost there as the two participants in a marital, extramarital affair in a bit of dialogue from David Gates share that tension at the bar. And it goes on with the kind of the narrator here saying, my Jack Daniels arrived. I looked over at the rows and rows of bottles. I said, whose would it be? He's getting very, me,
whose
myself, and I, the trouble is mounting for him in this dialogue.
Right. Whose would it be? She shrugged. Up for grabs, she said.
Up for grabs. My husband's, yours. Who knows? Somebody else. Jack, where does this all leave you? I mean, can we just rush out and read until the end of time here? Is there any end to the beauty and utility of it?
I like that comment that your friend made, Francine, that the novel will bury us. The writing will, far from the death of the novel and,
right.
and writing, it'll survive us all. And there's a comfort, isn't it, that these things are there laid up for us and ahead of us as well.
Well, it's for me, I have to say, it's been a huge comfort to hear these amazing passages that people have been calling in to read that are obviously so close to their hearts. I mean, the fact that that's going on out there all over the country really is great.
Does the critical mass matter? What if it's diminished? What if fewer people are reading this kind of prose? Where does that point us?
Well, you know, I like to think there's no predicting. I mean, maybe in 20 years, people will say, you know, I'm kind of tired of my Game Boy and my TV and my computer. I think I'll just open a novel and read it. And as long as the novel survives, as long as there are books, people are going to read them.
Francine Prose, we're so delighted to have had you with us and for your time and for your work here. Thank you very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you
with
so
the
much.
Thank Francine
you.
Prose, her new book is Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. And Jack Meaty, thanks so much for bringing your book bag along. Great to have you.
Thanks, John.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.